Republicans gathered at their party convention in New Orleans this week are spending a good deal of their time either making speeches or listening to them.
I've been doing a little remembering of my own because of all that inflated rhetoric by our friends in Atlanta last month. But then, inflation is their specialty.
Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has some thoughts on political oratory.
However the parties try to jazz up their conventions, there's no getting around the fact that they're still basically occasions for windy oratory, to the obvious distress of the networks who have to cover them. Whoever is up there thumping the lectern in Atlanta or New Orleans, the TV is almost sure to be carrying an interview with a 91-year-old delegate from Kansas, or a chat between Dan Rather and Walter Cronkite about the sorry state of this year's political oratory, while the camera pans the hall like a restless schoolboy. But there was a time when this sort of speechifying was regarded as the mainstay of democracy. In the words of one 19th century schoolbook, oratory is the parent of liberty. In fact, the famous McGuffey's Reader was really a textbook on public speaking, which began with instructions on articulation and gesture, and which included sample orations by the likes of Patrick Henry and Daniel Webster, which pupils were required to learn by heart. 19th century oratory was not just a political duty, but an enormously popular public entertainment. When Anthony Trollope visited the United States from England in 1861, he was astonished to find that public lectures outdrew theaters and concerts as popular attractions, so much so that 2,000 or 3,000 people might turn out to hear a star like Edward Everett or Ralph Waldo Emerson declaiming on the events of the day. And the people who attended one of the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1854 could expect to sit through as much as 7 hours of argument and rebuttal without commercial interruptions. The high watermark of 19th century political oratory was surely the 1896 Democratic Convention in Chicago, when a boy wonder ex-congressman from Nebraska named William Jennings Bryan carried off the nomination with a stirring oration attacking the gold standard, with its famous peroration, "You shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." Yet before Bryan died in 1925, he was regarded as a political fossil, though that's a word he probably would have objected to, the prototype for the pompous Senator gas bag that became a fixture of political cartoons. The old-fashioned oratory was partly a victim of the more informal style of the 20th century and partly of new technologies. Already in 1924, the Democratic Convention had been carried over the radio. Less than a decade later, FDR would hold the first of his fireside chats, which gave the illusion of a homey, intimate exchange between the president sitting in his parlor and the audience sitting in theirs. It remained only for television to make oratory appear grotesque. Indeed, TV seems to be unable to sit still for any form of language that can't be carried in a 15-second bite. And yet there are moments when the networks feel themselves obliged to carry a speech in its entirety, and when we suddenly get a glimpse of the magic that a great orator can work on a hall. There was Mario Cuomo's keynote address to the Democrats in 1984, and Jesse Jackson's speech this year. Unfortunately, the Republicans have been short on spellbinders since Everett Dirksen died. It's a reminder of how much fun 19th century American politics must have been, and you want to ask, in the words of the poet Vachel Lindsay, "Where is that boy, that heaven-born Bryan, that Homer Bryan, who sang from the West, gone to join the shadows with Altgeld the Eagle, where the kings and the slaves and the troubadours rest?"
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California.